You have just downloaded Re-Resolutions, a podcast brought to you by Yori Lives, the Tron fan campaign to return Cindy Morgan to the grid. We are the Tron fans who want our original characters back. In this first installment, we are honored to present an interview with Cindy Morgan, the actress who played Yori and Laura in Tron, and whose presence we request be returned to the world of Tron, be it in the new television series or Tron 3. Cindy Morgan, born in Chicago, Illinois, attended Mother Theodore Guerin High School for Girls, was accepted to the Illinois Institute of Technology to pursue mechanical engineering, but turned to Northern Illinois University for degrees in English communication, started out working graveyard shifts as a radio DJ, presented the weather on a TV news station in Rockford, Illinois, returned to Chicago to work for WSDM-FM, and then later moved to Los Angeles in 1978 to do commercials for Irish Spring, and later got the role of Lacey Underall in the hit comedy Caddyshack, starring Bill Murray and Chevy Chase in 1980. She landed the dual role of Dr. Laura Baines and Yori in the 1982 Disney science fiction film Tron. She has appeared in numerous television shows and movies, including Bring 'Em Back Alive with Bruce Boxleitner, The Love Boat, Chips, The Fall Guy, Matlock, Falcon Crest, Hunter, The Larry Sanders Show, Crazy Like a Fox, Steven Spielberg's Amazing Stories, Disney's Return of the Shaggy Dog, Harry and the Hendersons, and more. She has been associate producer on several movies and played the voice of characters on several video games, including Night Traveler and Tron 2.0. When you were younger, would you say that you were interested in science fiction in any way at all?
Absolutely. Yeah. A sci-fi fan. Big Jules Verne fan. And science fiction really was just sort of emerging. I think it really didn't come out until like the 60s and the 70s, where they got some really great budgets on films like, gosh, who's the guy in all of the Naked Gun pictures?
I know who you're talking about. I can't think of his name.
He did a sci-fi picture that had one of the first big budgets.
The Forbidden Planet.
Right. I saw that in high def. Holy smokes! I mean, big science fiction fan. Always was Jules Verne fan, and but when I got the script for Tron, I wasn't thinking science fiction. I was thinking, how do I make this real for me? You know, because if I was thinking science fiction, I wouldn't be delivering it honestly. So right. I had to make it real for me. It was tough. And there's one line I choked on, and the audience laughed to this day. There was one line, and I went to Lisberger. I said, I cannot say this line. I can't do it. My friends are coming to this movie. I cannot say this line. Well, try picking a fight with the director over a line with yourself or the writer. Just go ahead and try that someday. I can see how far you get. And the line is, oh, Tron, I knew there wasn't a circuit built that could hold you. I choked on the line, the audience to this day left, and now it's my favorite line in the movie, because you can't fool the audience.
Well, it fooled me, because I never considered it until I've heard about it in interviews from you. Never really thought much about that line.
Oh, God, in the theater, they just crack up when they hear me say it.
So you said, you mentioned that, you said you're worried about when your friends are going to go see this movie. When they did, the people that you knew, what did some of them say when you went, when they...
In truth, you know,
not about the line, but just about the movie in general.
Being in the film, it wasn't the greatest experience, unfortunately, because my contemporaries and a lot of my friends were also actors. And a lot of them came from Caddyshack, and I was the one who was actually working. And so it wasn't always happy and a happy experience, because they weren't always happy for me. It's like, you know, who do you think you are? I don't know. I'm just paying my bills. Just give me a break, you know. But luckily, I had a father who was very grounded. And I remember calling and saying, Dad, I got this movie called Tron. It's for Disney, and I'm going to make all this, you know, money. And I told him, at the time, it sounded extremely huge. And he said, his answer was, that's great sense when you're coming home. You know, and it was always, you know, do your job, go to work, and then, you know, go home. And just, so I had that was good for me, that it was drowning. People weren't overly crazy about it. In truth, it didn't really hit until much later.
Right.
So the re-release of Legacy put Tron, the original Tron, on the map.
But the younger audiences got into it when it came out.
Gosh,
I mean, everybody I knew was, you know, it was after Star Wars, and we were waiting for the next big thing.
Right.
And, of course, even though it was the same year that, like, some of the most famous science fiction movies of the 80s came out, Blade Runner, The Thing,
more Indiana Jones and all the the other Star Wars
films.
Better
believe it.
But Tron was it wasn't just something that was kind of like, well, yeah, then there's Tron. It was if you weren't watching Star Wars or Star Trek: The Wrath mm-hmm. of Khan or Blade Runner, you were watching Tron.
Right.
I mean, it was number.
Pretty cool. That's good to know.
A lot of people say, I read a lot of articles and they say, oh, well, Tron was a failure when it came. It wasn't a failure when it came out. It came in at number.
Who you ask? Because some people loved it.
Well,
as
just technically, it wasn't a failure. It was number two at the box office. It came
really?
Out.
Really?
It came out with, the final. I think the previous week was E.T.
That's right. E.T. came out right on the heels of it.
It was in the wake of that, and people were still going to see E.T. If E.T. hadn't come out,
sure.
People would have all gone to see Tron, and no one would have ever said it was a failure. It's not a failure. It made 33 million, which was mm-hmm. more than Blade Runner made, which was more than, more than The Thing. But, again, E.T. was the killer of that summer. You had, Star Trek... came out, the second one that everybody liked, and so they were all competing, not only that, but you had Spielberg also had Poltergeist and a re-release of Raiders of the Lost Ark, so they were just sort of double-teaming everything, trying to cash in, so they, but who still talks about E.T., though?
I just saw it the other day again. It's pretty cool, but it's really interesting how this film has evolved over time. I mean, it's sort of cool. It's a wonderful feeling that I know a lot of people who put a lot of good work into the original Tron. I see them on my Facebook page all the time. The artists, the graphic designers, the directors, the cinematographers. People who are And I rarely say this, but I'm going to say, people were, geniuses what they did with the work. I got in there and I plugged into a wonderful machine and I was just told to run from here to there and say that line. And right. These guys were amazing. So it's all them. The love and the magic they put into it. There is such a thing as movie magic. Right. Sometimes all the elements come together and it's like being struck by lightning. Yep. You can't plan it. Don't try it. But when it happens, it's awesome.
Well, here goes nothing.
Yeah, interesting. You hear what you just said? Here goes nothing.
Well, what I meant was...
Actually, what we proposed to do is to change something into nothing and back again. They might just as well have said, here goes something, here comes nothing.
Right, mm-hmm. Let's clear the area.
I remember the first time I did a reading of the script with Jeff Bridges and Bruce Boxleitner. I remember the audition with Jeff Bridges. I walked in and they put me right on tape with Jeff, with the director. And I don't know if you know how I got the job for Tron. I told the story a couple of times. Before Caddyshack, when I first got to L.A., right in that time between being a disc jockey and being an actor, I knew for a fact that I had no acting skills. So I got a commercial agent pretty quickly, and I walked into his back office, and I looked at all the pictures of their clients, and I pulled the photos of the ones I recognized and flipped them over and looked at where they studied. And the good thing about that was, one, I took two classes. One was a scene study class, which got rid of my disc jockey voice, which was really important, and another was a comedy improv class. So that helped me a lot with Caddyshack because they just tossed that script away. So while I was in this improv class, I was dating. I was on the third level down. There were three classes of 24, and I was on the third level down. But in the top class of 24, there were, out of 24 people, you had John Ritter, Penny Marshall, and Robin Williams. This guy taught comedy by the numbers. There was no mistaking. And I dated one of the guys in that class. And he took me to a lunch. He said he was going to be doing a cartoon. I went, okay. Cartoon. And I went to the lunch. I remember it was at the Chronicle in Venice, California. And I'm listening to them talk about this cartoon. And I'm like, okay, cartoon. And I didn't think much of it. Did Caddyshack. A year and a half later, I get called in not to audition, but to be put right on tape with Jeff Bridges for the director. It wasn't until many years later I ran into that actor, and I said, was that Tron? And he said, yes, and I've never taken another actor so much again. He actually had the original Tron, as I understand it. Flynn and Alan were the same, were one character.
Huh.
It wasn't until the film evolved that they were split into two characters. And he, Larry Anderson, who I've run into since, and I've apologized profusely, and I said, honestly, I wasn't going for your job. I was eating lunch. He had the job, but when it evolved, I think it was originally going to be a cartoon. And then they went to computer animation. And that's what separated it from the past. And at that point, Disney got a hold of it. At that point, they attached names, which were Jeff Bridges, was already attached. I was second to be attached. And then Bruce Boxleitner came in after.
Right.
Every day was, in my mind, very much like, I just stopped reading the script because it didn't seem to matter. I would walk in, and it was like, went from here to there. It was a very physical job, which was, luckily, Bruce is a very physical actor. Went from here to there, jump on this, and then say this. And that was the one day I finally said, okay, I just got to ask. I walked in one morning, and Steven Lisberger said, okay, you're on the Solar Sailor today. You're on the Getting Sea. Go ahead. And that's when I said, all right, I just got to ask you. What the hell are you talking about? There's no Solar Sailor. There's no Getting Sea. I don't understand. And oh, by the way, there's nothing there. There's no ship, and there's nothing to fly. What are you talking about? And at that point, he pulled out these great Disney graphics, and he showed me pictures of what it would look like. And he said, just go to that table and just do anything. The Disney artist will fill it in underneath you. So I looked at that table, and I had to see something, because otherwise I would be lying, and now they could know. So in my mind's eye, I saw a soundboard in front of me. And that soundboard somehow was driving this vehicle forward. And that's what I saw. And it worked out. It was also the day that I was done wearing the skull cap. I don't know if you heard that story.
You mean the hat?
That chamois thing that was glued to my head. It was chamois cloth with wiring. On the outside, and it was
right.
Glued to my skin, so it would stay in place in my hair wouldn't show. But, you know, which was fine for a day or two or a week, but after a few weeks, you know, they kept the wardrobe would, you know, gank on it to put it in place, and the glue would tear, and, you know, eventually my skin was blistering under it, and eventually they were gluing it to my blisters, and there was one day that, you know, it wasn't just the pain. I mean, I was ready to start bleeding, and I said, that's it. I'm not wearing this thing today. I grabbed one of the hockey helmets like the guy wearing it. I said, I'm wearing this today. And I just cut the Solar Sailor and did it. That looked better, but I just couldn't wear it one more day. I love suffering for my art, but, you know, give me a break.
This is Flynn, the one who busted me out.
Laura?
Well, then I owe him some thanks.
No, it's, no big deal. I had to know my way around the light cycle routine. I wrote the program for it.
You wrote the program?
It's time I level with you. I'm what you guys call a user.
You're a user?
I took a wrong turn somewhere.
But if you are a user, then everything you've done has been according to a plan, right?
You wish.
When you were doing Caddyshack, I've read that they sit you down to watch Lauren Bacall movies to prepare for your character.
That was part of the prep. Yeah.
In Tron, did Steven Lisberger give you any kind of character specific direction? Like, did they say read this or look at that or? Anything?
No, he didn't. He did make one comment that I found odd, and I only heard it one other time, and it was by the editor of Caddyshack, who called me a couple of weeks ago. When I went in for the first interview, the first audition after the lunch, about a year and a half later, Steven said, I'm saying this just because I'm repeating it, clearly I see no resemblance whatsoever. he said, does everybody you meet compare you to Marilyn Monroe? And I said, oh, yeah, all the time. I had no idea what he was talking about. But I don't know if it was an expression or a facial feature that day or whatever it was, but I got nothing. I got nothing. And so in my mind, I had to think of something. So I remember, again, going back to science fiction, the films that were out at the time where somebody would be on a tropical island and have very little information about what lived went on in the real world. And in my mind, the character, Yori, was like that. It had an innocence. It was a two-dimensional version of Laura. But she was on this tropical island, separated from reality in the real world, and had an innocence. And a lot of things were new to her. And that was the character choices I made, because I had to make some choices and make them fast. Because I was working before I knew it.
I've read that when asked, or you were doing, I guess, interviews, maybe it was television early on or something, promotional, and when people asked you, you know, what exactly is this movie, or what...
I compared it to The Wizard of Oz.
Compared it to The Wizard of Oz, which to me is interesting, because not only does that seem to be one of the few movies that you could compare it to, because it, not only in the sort of character setup, but the idea that instead of like a tornado, it's a laser. Somebody goes into this other world, and there, that's one layer of the movie that's interesting. And
that everybody that he knew in the other world, well, many people he knew in the other world existed. Because I was the one who did the press junket. I did it by myself. Jeff wasn't available. Bruce wasn't available. I did it alone, and I went from city to city explaining to people what Tron was about, and I left the whole CGI thing off, because to tell you the truth, nobody knew what CGI was. Nobody cared,
right?
But they wanted to know about the story. So I explained that, like in The Wizard of Oz, there's a person in one world who gets transported to another world where a lot of the people he knew exist,
right? And it does operate like that, even though it operates on other levels, which are you know, interesting. But I always thought the Wizard of Oz comparison is pretty good for one specific sort of metaphor of the movie.
I had to find something that was relevant that people could relate
right, like,
to.
Like Bruce Boxleitner compares it to Spartacus. You couldn't get more different than Wizard of Oz and Spartacus, but that.
Well, maybe that's how he saw it.
But
Bruce and I do things very differently. That's why we're so good together on screen.
But you'd be amazed at the variety of what people compare it to and what they get from it. I've read.
I can see where he got that. I can see that.
I've read one article that suggested that Tron is the perfect illustration of schizophrenia. I've read one article that said that Tron was like some sort of Cold War analogy. You know, people get a lot
really?
Of lot of bizarre, sometimes interesting things out of
cool
it.
The cool thing is that I heard that's, I think, what makes art. Anybody can look at it and walk away with a different picture in their mind. People can tap into the common human denominator and then walk away with something different. I think that's amazing, and I think that's a wonderful thing.
Right. I mean, it certainly has this sort of universal story, and then, of course, that's probably why people mm-hmm. from all over the world are checking out the site and everything, but...
I know. I just love it. I you've got to know that inside I'm just smiling. I'm just, you know, we're all... I just think it's amazing, and I can't help but smile. I think it's pretty cool.
It's interesting with the schizophrenia, and you could almost imagine, you know, different personalities with the different people, some people in the digital world, and then you have, you know, Laura. That's interesting. And also, I just wanted to point out, in Tron Legacy, Kaczynski, when describing it, also used to point out the whole Wizard of Oz reference, too. So,
maybe he read my interview.
Well, the thing is I think all of those things work in a way, and I think one of the I guess, I don't really like to use the word genius because I don't really believe there is such a thing as a genius, because mm-hmm. I think lots of people all over the world have the same ideas. It's just sort of circumstance by which the right
exactly.
person comes at the right time, you know.
Exactly.
But there is certainly, there was a lot of effort put into it, and I guess I would in this instance use the word genius, but all of these, I think, if you look carefully, The Wizard of Oz, schizophrenia, people draw in the religious sort of analogies.
Yes, very much so.
They are all actually in there, and in a way, the movie has this effect of, because of its universality, maybe, that it sort of unites people in a way. You know, like, I have people that are complete technology people that love everything that's in the movie, and then you have, I've read these, like, when Tron Legacy came out, that some church had remodeled their the inside of their community center to make it look like Tron, you know, which is bizarre. But, you know, there's certainly...
I saw those photos for a while.
But there's the universality of it, but what I think people should look at is they should also, if they do come from it from that perspective, they should also take a look at the other perspectives, because what starts to happen if you look closer is... And Steven Lisberger was asked in a panel discussion once that I watched. I guess somebody had traveled from Germany to ask him, was this intentional? Did you intentionally put a lot of these, you know, spiritual messages in this? And Steven Lisberger said, yeah. And the guy from Germany said, okay, I can go back to Germany now.
I think Steven really had a vision of what he wanted,
right, but what's interesting about Tron is the multi-layered aspect of that it actually says something when you connect these two things, like, you know, X plus Y equals Z, but then the implications mm-hmm. of, if you take the religious metaphor and then contrast it to the technology or the predictive, you know, futuristic technology, or if you can contrast it with the idea of what's going on psychologically, then you pull even more from the movie. So, like, it isn't just necessarily this is a religious guy's point of view or a technology guy's point of view. It's it is all actually in there, you know. And as even though it's this most simplistic story, you know, it's like a fairy tale.
It's a common human denominator,
right.
Like a fairy tale, yes.
And I think it will last for a really long time because of that, because it's not what it on the face of it, maybe that's what baffled people, is the simplistic sort of story of good guys and bad guys and things like that, and then they can't...
Well, it had a lot of innocence. It really did.
Right.
And what's so cool about now is it's still relevant to the times now. I think we've mentioned, you know, that wonderful Tron graphic about free the system. Remember that?
Uh-huh.
About making it a free system. It's so relevant to the internet today.
You know,
that's what makes Tron so relevant now, too. So it's just like, you know, trying to get more of the street cred than it gets sometimes, you know. But we're kind of in a bubble. You know, I'm in the Tron bubble. Not everybody, you know, loves Tron, I guess, you know.
But. They do now.
They certainly don't hate it, that's for sure. I mean,
there's
nobody out there. There's nobody out there with, you know, Tron Legacy, you know, like the Star Wars thing, you know, like everybody hated the sequels or whatever. And, there's nobody out there saying, they trashed it, you know, it's done. They ruined it forever, you know, Steven Lisberger ruined my child. No one's out there saying that. As a matter of fact, they're more interested in it now than you know, according to... all the actors and the director, that from what I've heard, is they're more interested in it now than they ever were. So
I think that's so cool. And just so you know, when they do appearances, it used to be I've got stats on my side too. 79%, my demographic was 79% male. Now there's a whole new demographic that I'm seeing, and that's young women in their late teens and 20s, and that's never was there before. They love Tron. Well, there's a lot of people who love Tron, but that's something new I'm seeing now, which is pretty darn cool.
One of the key things I think now with it is probably it's not even necessarily the whole computer world thing, but the main plot, which is about a guy and his intellectual property rights. I mean, like, you know, this corporation has stolen his ideas.
Oh, I know.
And his remedy for that situation is to get on the computer and do something about it. That's sort of really huge right now, you know, all over the world with the current issues.
It's all about money and power.
Yeah.
And it's more so. You better believe it.
And not to mention that at the end, it's like the three characters are like, they go back into the company and they're like the whistleblowers. They are going to publish, you know, the evidence on the computer so everyone can know that.
But it takes a lot. Just so you guys know, I'm not going to say what it was for. In the last couple of years, I was handed a contract to sign. And it said to sign off on this in perpetuity throughout the universe. That's the exact word. I didn't sign it.
For what now?
I'm not going to say what it was for, but I was asked to sign away my right, sign away on something. People are using different language now.
Oh, yeah. They try everything they can.
I can't even say the word, but that's, you know, forever. It's a really long time, right?
In perpetuity throughout the universe? I can't believe they're using words like that.
Right, yeah, that's not good. Not good. So.
It's really been picked up by the press how they've never, what a phenomenon it is that fans like, wait a minute, you know, what's going on here? And that was picked up, and Spike came up, and the press picked it up and said that people liked this character and took it very personally. That wasn't
installment.
That's pretty darn cool.
Well, and a lot of people say, imagine if Tron didn't have, you know, Sydney Morgan in it, it just would not have been the same movie.
It would have had that Deborah Harry. She was the other one up for the role.
Yeah,
what has she
done?
What
she would have brought to it, really, you know. So.
But that's, what did you say then?
I said I don't. Besides Videodrome, what else did she do?
I don't know. She was also up for it. As I understand, that's what I was told.
So when you were doing the promotions for Tron, did you get to go outside the country? Did you go to England or anything?
I wish that was all in the States. It was a city every day, and it was grueling. And I went right from that into Bring Them Back Alive. I would wake up in the morning and either start my interviews at like 6 a.m. or hop a plane at 6 a.m. and then you go to a hotel and you do interviews all day long, and then you go to the next city and you go to sleep and then you start all over. It was something. All I remember is I insisted on bringing somebody with me so that I would have a point of reference myself, because I didn't know where the hell I was. I mean, I would wake up and just, you know, have to look at the phone. What city am I in today?
Well, is it more fun to do the convention thing now than the promotion of the movie?
No, to tell you the truth, it's all work. The hard part is making it look kind of easy. that's the part that takes a little doing. But as far as fun, it really is like an athletic event. You have to be on your game. You have to have your wits about you. You have to be physically fit. And thank God for my background in broadcasting, because in 2 hours on tours of sleep, I could still talk to you about the film. It's fun, but it's work fun. You know, when you see guys playing sports, whatever sport you like, they're having fun because they have passion for what they're doing. But they also have their wits about them, and they're working at 180%.
I'd like to talk to you about the Lawrence Livermore. When you film there, did they give you a tour or anything? Did they, before you started filming, sort of blocked off an area and they just sort of said, okay, we're going to film this? Or did you get to meet any of the
people? They blocked off an area, we showed up, and they said, go from here to there and say this and that. That was it.
But
I think you did hear the story about how I decided that I would take a shortcut to the makeup trailer.
Right, now this is interesting.
You've heard about this?
Right, yeah.
It was an area that was taped off for some reason, but I'm going over there, so I don't care what you guys are doing, I'm going that way. And I would, like, out there, like, 10 steps, and somebody goes, stop, freeze! And, like, these techs came over and walked me backwards and cleaned off my shoes. Apparently, I walked into something.
How long
did you shoot there?
Huh? I don't remember. We did this for a couple of days. 2-3 days. Yeah.
Now, did you get to
mostly underground? I saw in an interview you mentioned a lot of it was mostly underground, and you were surprised that you were even able to film there, right?
Yes, I don't know why the hell we were there. So, well, just like Caddyshack, why did they give you guys gasoline and big rope a golf course? How the heck we got into Lunar Roulette, I'll never know, but we were like, they went stories down into the ground.
Yeah, and then they would probably drive you to the set, right, and stay somewhere locally.
The set was under the ground.
So now, what I've read is that when you walked through this taped-off area, that they made you stop and they had to decontaminate your shoes or something.
Correct. Right. Exactly. I froze. They ran a couple techs ran up, and I guess I don't remember if they walked me off and grabbed the shoes. I think that's what they did. But they, you know, they just freaked. And the thing was, we had the whole film crew there. And everybody's working, and it was like, this is taped off, and I don't see why. I don't see a big deal. And I was just, I got to go that way. Well, apparently not. So.
Well, it's pretty amazing, because I don't know of any other movie that was filmed there, either.
No, it is. I think it is the only movie that was filmed there. I think I read that.
The fact that any movie was filmed there, it defies imagination. I think that Disney, they carried a great deal of weight with them, that they needed a site that had this kind of, you know, But I have no idea how we got there or why we were there, and they certainly did not give us a tour or a map or instructions point. You know, we were there, we did our job, and that was it. Huh. Back to the hotel.
And a lot of people...
Why the hell we were in there, I can't tell you. It really doesn't make any more sense than giving the people working in Caddyshack gasoline and going up golf courses. I have no idea why we were there or how we got there, but we were there.
It works for the setting, of course. You know.
Mithria, I want answers. Why did you digitize me?
The situation had become critical. My existence was threatened by the spread of the corruption.
So you dragged me in here because of a virus?
Alan 1 computed that a user would be 526 times more powerful operating from within the system than from without.
Why me?
Alan 1 was not available. Alan 2 was.
My name is Jet. Alan is my father.
Father? You mean Alan 1 is an earlier version of you?
Well, something like that. My father.
I guess we should probably... I want to ask you about Tron 2.0, the video game. Because it's one of the things that always kind of gets left out in interviews and stuff. And it's still a pretty popular game with a certain... You know, it has this... an audience still. I mean, people are still into it. And
that was a very tasted together situation. As I understand it, and this is just what I got through people I know who are on some other websites. Actually, my webmaster, Scott Burchak, his name's out there now, told me the story that the game was being planned. My character, Laura, had been killed. As Mark Twain said, the reports of my death are greatly exaggerated.
Right.
And my understanding is some people wanted me back. And so the character of Mithria was written. I was given no script. I was given no information. I was living in New York at the time. The director was in L.A. And I was sent 3 pages of copy that was unrelated to any storyline whatsoever. And I got no information except that Mithria is a program in a game and says these lines. So I had to think, I had to look at this and think. I said, all right. I remember doing film. If I was Laura, and I knew what I already knew, that Flynn was blown into the computer, I already knew what could possibly happen. And if I were to have a son, and I knew something could happen to me, I would do anything I possibly could to take care of him. So in my mind, I saw Mithria as an extension of something that Laura would have put into the computer to keep an eye on Jed.
I think, isn't that what the story... was?
As it turned out. I have no idea.
Yeah.
To tell you the truth, when they actually sent me the game, my computer didn't have enough memory to play it. And I never ended up getting to that level. I had to get that game and hear it sometime because I'd love to hear what happened. And let me tell you, the challenge didn't stop there. Let me take it up a couple levels. At the time I was living in New York, I was living in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, across the bridge. And there was one of the rare snowstorms that shut down the subway system in New York City. So I gave up that morning to go do the job in Manhattan, and there's no subway system. So I, just like I did with my wife, I got onto the street and I looked around and I got a hold of a gypsy cab, which if you live in New York, you know it there. I said, I need you to take me to the other side of the bridge. Well, I said, here's $20, do it. So we got to the other side of the bridge. And from there, I found another taxi, because technically taxis belonged in different areas. I didn't ask. I got over there, got another taxi, and got to the sound studio, and the engineer didn't show up. So his assistant, luckily, was there. And still, I know nothing about this script. I got 3 pages of copy that makes no sense to me. And I've got the director on headphones. So that was all I had to work with. Voiceover work is something, well, because of my background in radio, I do in my sleep. I mean, I remember a number of times when I worked at my first radio station, I was just handed an LP. Literally, just handed. I mean, and I had very little music background. I wasn't much of a club person or even outgoing. And I was handed an LP, and they would say, make us a commercial. I'd say, sure, fine. And I'd go, what the? I would listen to tracks. I would pull tracks that I could loop together so that I would get 30 seconds of time or 28, whatever amount of time I needed. And then I would look at it and I'd write copy and I'd lay the copy in over the tracks and I'd bring it. So, you know, a lot of times you're not given information. You better have a damn good mind's eye.
They just expect you to come up with, that's your job, right?
Yeah, on the spot.
So that took, what, a week or something?
No, that was like a day.
Oh, one day, yeah. Yeah, there's. It seemed like there was a lot of lines when.
There were a lot of lines that were not tied together with no storyline making. I did the same. I'm a little nervous about listening to it because I can't imagine how it came out to be. But there it is. Yeah. I had no information on that. But again, animation might be quite like this.
I'm not super fond of how the characters might look, but the visuals in the whole computer game are really cool. You know, but you sound great, and then, you know, we're like, hallelujah, you know, Laura Bradley is alive.
I'm excited about what we are, what we have to show you tonight. We think it's the best of old income, packaged in the best of the new income. Our newest product takes us back 30 years. I know Laura and I were just saying that. Well, Laura's with me right now. She never misses a chance to come to San Francisco, believe me, to shop. Anyway, so she should be up here. Honey, come on up here now. Here she is. Listen, anyone who knows income knows how vital... Anyone who knows income knows how vital she was to its success. And so, here's my lovely bride.
Good to see you, Alan. I can't tell all of you how good it is to be here tonight. And, geez, it was just like yesterday. I was over at income, and what was I doing at my computer station? I was digitized in orange, I think, right?
Yes, I remember.
Well, the future sure has passed us by quickly. And now it's here. And I just want to tell each and every one of you how good it is to see you tonight. Thank you for coming.
I want to thank this lady for all her amazing support throughout the years.
Oh, my God. Yeah, that was something. I hadn't seen Bruce in a while. And again, there were no lines. There was no copy. And they threw a couple lines at me. And there was an amazing, and apparently some of Legacy was being filmed or had been filmed the night before, or they had tried this. This was in the middle of San Francisco. I'm out freaking sitting on the bay where their side went. And they took a chopper off, as I understand, from Oakland Airport to drop the skydiver press conference. Why a press conference going on? Now, again, this is just from my FCC background. Some of it included FAA regulations because of our towers. People do need to check with the FAA before you take a chopper off and just start dropping people. They do need this information. So apparently there was a restriction because of the high winds, and Bruce was on stage doing his lines, and Bruce is out of line. And it's live, and I did something I don't think anybody wanted or expected, but I just walked up and grabbed him by the hand and said, okay, Hal, thank you all for coming here tonight. So it was edited several different ways, but that's why Bruce and I work well together, because we trust each other and we know what to do.
There's the deleted scene on the DVD.
Yes,
I'm assuming it's on the Blu-ray. I don't have the Blu-ray, so I'm assuming it's all the same.
Right. I remember that date very clearly. That's the date that stood out. I remember that date very well. That was a very rough day. I was sewn into that costume.
Sewn?
Needle and thread sewn into the costume.
Huh.
And I couldn't sit down, so they gave me a torture device from the 40s, I guess, called a leaning board that they would give actresses when they're sewn into the costume. I'd rather stand on my feet, but I'm uncomfortable. That was a rough day, tough situation, black stage. All the studio suits were down that day watching the scene, and I'm on my feet all day sewn into a costume, not only not eating. When you're sewn into a costume, you don't go anywhere, you're just there. And so, just the fact that Bruce and I got along so well is the only way that we got through that day.
There's pictures, shots of Bruce Boxleitner with his hair sticking up.
I know.
Was that part of the scene, or were those just sort of promotional experimentation shots?
That was the image of the hairdresser that day. That's all that was.
Okay, because everybody wonders.
I've got all kinds of theories on what I think it looks like, but that was just for the hairdresser did that.
Because there's lots of little things. Now, do you remember, were there any other scenes that you might have filmed that you can recall that might not have made it in the film?
In some cases, it's possible, because there was so much running from here to, again, picture a black warehouse. You go to work every day for 6 weeks in this black warehouse. There's nothing there. So you show up in the morning, you're running from here to there, and you say these lines. For example, at the end of the film, when Dumont shows Tron and Yori this beautiful world lighting up, we are at the corner of the stage in the proscenium, I believe they call it, just the corner of the stage, and the cinematographer had us back up like 2 feet from the corner. I'm looking at a freaking wall. There's nothing there. But as Barnard Hughes, one of our actors, pointed, we're looking at a corner. Just so you understand, we're standing in the corner or looking at a corner. But as Barnard Hughes waves his hand, you know, he says, look at all this. We saw what they wanted us. Arnold was a wonderful actor. David Warner, astonishingly amazing actor. What a powerful actor. And that guy told me I was going to die. No acting required. I believe him.
Right, he's a good actor.
Holy smokes, Lizzie. Is he ever? Yeah.
He should have been in the other movie, I think. I think lots of people are...
Yeah. David's wonderful. Wonderful, wonderful man and very powerful actor. Arnold Hughes, again, wonderful actor and the most patient man in the world. When he was in that Dumont costume, I don't know if you know, but when I go to the I.O. tower, poor guy was sweating, and it was hot in the light, and now raising my feet a certain way, because, again, very Wizard of Oz looking. It sure as hell looked like I was going to see the wizard that day.
Right.
And I'm telling him, talking to him, and that scene took hours to film. And just those few lines, and Barnard was just, I could see him respiring. And this is a man of a certain age, Broadway star, legend, and he was the best behaved person on that set. He was patient, he was good every time. I mean, I'll tell you, it really shows you how a professional operates. He was very, very good to work with.
Yeah, it makes you wonder how he was even fitted in that thing, the way it...
He wasn't fitted into it. He crawled in underneath it. It was a device. It wasn't a costume. It was built that he crawled up into it and sat in.
And then it rotated.
I can't remember what.
Yeah, it was a mechanical device. You know, here he is rotating around inside this little thing. And
yeah.
if you're stuck there and they're setting up more shots or something, he's just got to sit there.
That's right. And you can see his blood. I mean, I can see it.
How many passes of the helicopter were there when they were filming the roof scene? Did you guys stand up there all day and... Oh, just two?
And let me tell you something. I believe there were two passes, and let me tell you, they did not tell us what was going to happen. At that time, a lot of the... In Tron, in that shot, and a lot of Bring Them Back Alive, our chopper pilots were ex-Vietnam vets. And they were... Whoa! I mean, just let me tell you... Thank God, I mean, I remember doing the scene in another film, and thank God I got in and buckled my damn seatbelt. Because that chopper pilot took off 10 feet off the ground, turned on its side, and went straight down the side of a cliff on the ocean, on the Pacific Ocean. Thank God I had the presence of mind. I'm getting in the chopper. I'll buckle my seatbelt. Well, there were no doors on the damn thing, and thank God I buckled it. And on that shot, I was on the top of the building. I think it's an even taller building in L.A. at the time. And we're standing up there, and we're expecting the helicopter. I'm expecting something to fly in from a distance. This chopper pilot, again, took off, I'm guessing, on his side, up the side of the building, and just, boom. If you can see, I'm up fast. I was being blown off the building. You do see that I was hanging on to something, a railing, mm-hmm. and Bruce was holding me. I mean, that thing was blowing me. Oh, it just, like, caught up the side of the building. And I think he made a second pass in for camera.
Do you remember a lot of rewrites or anything like that on the Tron script? Or
again, this was a case of I would show up for work in the morning. You know, on a television show, very often there are rewrites and you get different color pages. When I was shooting Tron, it was, you know, all these things, I hope you understand, are shot out of sequence. You do know that. And they're shot on a completely black set with no reality, no points of reference, no beginning, middle, and end. If there was a rewrite, I didn't know about it. I would show up and do whatever was... I stopped reading the script because it didn't matter. I would show up for work that day, and we were shooting X scene out of sequence on the same stage that I've been on for 6 weeks. So I showed up and had found out what was the sequence of that day.
Right. Was there a scene that you remember that was the hardest to film on Tron, or it was, like, the most challenging?
What scene? Was hell.
Yeah. So they always look good on camera, but I've heard that it's not.
Yeah, you get sewn into a costume and stand all day and not eat or sleep or use the bathroom. That's me. Tell me how you feel.
Yeah, but I think it's some of the most beautiful scenes, especially.
It's beautiful. I know it is.
You know, is brought up and also the love scene. Everybody loves the lead at love scene. So
yeah, I know.
I know you're working a lot, but was there anybody in particular that you kind of made friends with, like was it Bernard Hughes to talk to a little bit, or
this burger put video games on the set for us to play.
And
the good thing about that was there were a couple of things about that. Otherwise, our minds would have gone to sleep, and it kept us alive and active. And it also, he wanted us to be in that state of mind. You know, he that helped a bit.
So you played a lot of games.
No, we didn't hang out just. There was no hanging out and chit-chatting. We were freaking working with the studio suits up, watching us. This wasn't a party. This was ours.
And once again, I'd like to thank Cindy Morgan for giving us her time to do this interview. She'll be appearing at WonderCon March 16th through the 18th. You can visit her website, www.cindy-morgan.com. Follow her on Twitter at twitter.com/CindyMorganInfo. You can go to the blog where you had to have downloaded this podcast, and there's a link right on the first page there for which will take you to sign the petition to return Cindy Morgan to Tron and support the Yuri Lives campaign. You can be a friend of Cindy Morgan on Facebook. You can be a friend of Yuri Lives at Facebook, or you can join the Yuri Lives Facebook group, which is different, and there you can post your links, pics, information, exchange ideas, whatever, complaints, criticisms, however. You can email us at yurilives@yahoo.com. Thank you for your support, and thanks for listening.